Our final speaker today is Tom Snedden. He's the director of the PACE program, the largest prescription drug program for the elderly in the country. I spent a lot of time calling around the country to find out who would be the absolute best people to bring in to talk with state policymakers about prescription drugs. And I can't tell you how many people recommended this man to me. He's consulted with almost every state in the nation about what he's learned about designing prescription drug programs in the 15, almost 16 years now that he's been directing the PACE program. And since the legislature reauthorized the PACE program in 1987, they've implemented a number of cost-saving measures, which he'll tell you about, I'm sure, and they have a very unique funding source, which he'll also tell you about. I must tell you that it is a bit embarrassing to bring in the best people in the country and then give them 20 minutes to speak. But frankly, I feel a little less guilty about you because of a little information I found on the web on Mr. Tom Snedden. Now, according to my research, you ran 1 mile in the Millersville Mile Open in 4 minutes and 55 seconds. Are you that, Mr. Tom Snedden? I'm giving you four times that long to cover... to cover the ground on Pennsylvania's prescription drug program, PACE. So why don't you just run right up here and get started.
Thank you, and good morning. I have quite a bit of information to give you in a rather short period of time, and forgive me if I ad-lib a little bit here, because I'm, as I understand the task, I'm trying to help many of you come to a consensus on how you would design a benefit to help older Wisconsin residents in meeting the cost of their prescription drugs. And I think what you need to understand before I talk to you at some length about Pennsylvania's program is that virtually every state in the country has wrestled with this issue over the past quarter of a century. And half of them, I think 25 states today, now have what they consider to be at least some sort of solution to helping their older state residents with their out-of-pocket prescription drug needs. And as I look at those states today, what I see is that since we started our program in the early 80s, states have adopted, generally speaking, four different approaches to this problem. Early on, and New Jersey, by the way, was the mother of all state pharmacy programs. They started theirs in 75, and Pennsylvania really cloned our PACE program off of New Jersey. And this was the first kind of approach to prescription drug coverage for older people. And I call it a comprehensive approach. It's providing somebody with first dollar coverage, no co-payments, or I'm sorry, nominal co-payments, and virtually no limits beyond that, no caps. That's a very expensive model. That's the Lamborghini Maserati model, if you will. What states came to learn from our experience, I think, was embodied in the New York approach, which started in 1987. New York took a catastrophic approach, which is very much like our PACENET program, wherein there's an annual deductible of some significance and higher copays than nominal. Again, no caps, but front end loaded to require more cost sharing on the part of the enrollee. And that's more like your Rolls-Royce model. Later on, as we got into the 90s and other states were looking at the problem still, they decided that, gee, that's expensive too. Maybe we want a Lexus. And so states like California and Florida, for example, have gone to a discount model wherein they provide their older state residents with a price on the prescription that's equivalent to what their state Medicaid programs pay. That's your Lexis model, and it doesn't cost the state anything really, but it costs the pharmacies a great deal. Then you have your other model, and I'm not sure whether this is a Chevy or not, but Maine is the best example wherein they have tried to regulate prescription drug prices, put cost controls on what manufacturers and pharmacies can charge for prices. So there's four different approaches, and for any of you who are interested, I think the best summary that I've seen on that to date is the General Accounting Office's summary, which they put out in September of last year, and it's report 00-162. I'll be happy to... It is in the briefing. Excellent. The other one is the AARP report. AARP put out in April of 99 an excellent summary of each state program. And so either one of those are excellent. I think also in the briefing report is a synopsis of the PACE annual report. And I have a limited number of copies here today that I'll be happy to give to anybody. And if more are needed, Karen has said that she will be the conduit for those. So now let me tell you a little bit about the Lamborghini of state pharmacy assistance programs. It goes by its acronyms, PACE and PACE-NET, which very few legislators in Pennsylvania even know what it stands for. But it stands for Pharmaceutical Assistance Contract for the Elderly, or Pharmaceutical Assistance Contract for the Elderly Needs Enhancement Tier. Nobody cares what they stand for. PACE and PACE-NET are just synonymous with good stuff in Pennsylvania. Now, I like people to understand about PACE and PACE-NET, what exactly this benefit is. It's a comprehensive and a defined drug benefit. That is to say, it's first dollar coverage. As soon as you're qualified for enrollment in the program, we begin to pay for your prescriptions. There's no deductible, there's no annual fees, nothing like that. It's right out of the blocks, you're covered with a defined benefit, which is basically any prescription medication as well as insulin and insulin syringes and needles, we will cover. It's literally a one-size-fits-all drug benefit, which is one of the reasons why it's so expensive. It's a standalone benefit administration. This is a good example of government siloing of program activities. In other words, we don't care about hospitalizations. We don't care about physician payments because we're not involved with them. All we care about is our drug budget, standalone administration of the program, not tied into Medicaid, not tied into the Department of Public Welfare, not tied into the Department of Health, strictly standalone. It's not an insurance program, and it's not a discount program, nor is it an entitlement program. Was enacted in 1983, so it's been around almost two decades. Karen mentioned it has a unique funding source. Indeed it does. Of all the state pharmacy assistance programs across the country, none of them use their state lottery money to pay for this. We do. In fact, I'd say it's fair to say that if Pennsylvania had not enacted a state lottery in 1972, and it had not been so successful at generating such a large surplus by the early 80s, there never would have been a PACE program in Pennsylvania because we couldn't have afforded it. Since the enactment of the program, we've had to go in and amend it four times, largely either to expand eligibility or to control costs. Controlling costs in this program is a continuing political headache for Pennsylvania, and we'll get into that shortly. The eligibility for the program is fairly simple and straightforward. You have to be 65 years of age or older, 30 days prior to your application. You must be a state resident at least 90 days prior to application. And then if you're single, to qualify for PACE, your income cannot exceed $14,000 in the calendar year prior to application, or if you're married, $17,200. And PACENET, the income levels are $2,000 above that. So between $14,000 and $16,000 for single eligibility, $17,200 and $19,200 for married. These income levels, depending on which one you pick, range anywhere between 150 and 190% of the federal poverty levels. Now, if you are enrolled in the Medicaid prescription benefit in Pennsylvania, we will not enroll you in the PACE benefit, and we do a daily match with the state's Medicaid program to check enrollment in that program to make sure that they can't get into PACE. What's very interesting, though, is that with the advent of PACE, we have found many people in the Commonwealth who are eligible for Medicaid that won't enroll just so they can enroll in the PACE program. It drives enrollment out of Medicaid and into PACE. This I think, is a very important slide. Pennsylvania has 1.9 million people who are 65 and older. Of that population, 935,000 meet the criteria I just gave to you. But of that number, only 235,000 are enrolled in these programs. And people commonly ask, well, what happened to the other 700,000? Well, I think based on some of the information that that Bruce just gave you, many of these people have other coverage, or has belies the stereotype that lots of people have of older people, they don't need prescription medication. I mean, we find in Pennsylvania that 15% of our older residents simply don't take prescription medications, and that 35% above that take less than $500 a year. So they don't see themselves as needing to go through the process to get the coverage. They just don't use that much in the way of prescription medication. Now, beyond that, we have a lot of people that have other coverage through former employers, people who are enrolled in a Medicare-certified HMO. Some have Medigap coverage, and some are enrolled in the Medicaid program. What we have found in terms of the analyses that we've done is that there aren't too many people in Pennsylvania that don't know about this program or don't know enough to get enrolled in it. It's not like the unenrolled eligible simply don't know about it. There are program limits. You can only get a 30-day supply at any one time, 30 days or 100 units. There's a $6 copay, but there are no formulary restrictions and there are no annual caps. We have some people in this program that are getting $40,000 a year in prescription benefits. The average is $1,500 a year. That's the net average. Now, PACENET is different. PACE, of course, remember, is the comprehensive approach. PACENET is the catastrophic approach. It's front-end loaded. People have to meet a $500 annual deductible. Copays are obviously higher than the six in PACE, $8 generic and $15 brand. But again, no formulary restrictions and no annual caps. So once you're in benefit, you're covered. Cost containment. As I mentioned a moment ago, containing cost in this program has been the number one issue almost since the day it was implemented. Pennsylvania currently is spending on this program $1 million per day. That's our gross outlay, $1 million per day, going up at 20% annualized. Now, what have we done so far to contain costs? Well, we have mandatory generic substitution. What we say is that if you're taking or you're prescribed a multi-source brand product and there is a therapeutically equivalent generic that's been approved by the FDA, then we're only going to pay for that generic. That makes a big difference because usually on average, the cost of the generic claim is about a third of what it is for the brand name claim. Manufacturer rebates. Manufacturer rebates save us a lot of money. We take back $50 million a year in rebates from pharmaceutical manufacturers. The law says that if you're going to have your drugs covered by the PACE program, then you as a manufacturer are going to have to sign a rebate agreement with us and pay us rebates quarterly based upon the volume of products that we cover from your manufacturer line. There's really no option for manufacturers, given the size of this program, but to sign up. And we have been very aggressive in enforcing that mandate. We don't care whether you're Bristol-Myers or Merck or anybody else. If you don't pay your rebates and pay them on time, we stop paying for your products. It's just that simple. Saves a lot of money. I don't know how you can do a program of this size without getting rebates from manufacturers. We have mandatory drug utilization review edits. I'm sure all of you have read recently in the lay press about problems with mismedication of Americans generally, but older people in particular. In our program, we have a process whereby if we feel that the medication you are about to be dispensed is not appropriate, either in terms of the product itself, its duration, its dose, or the mix of medications that you're on, we don't pay for it. I think we're the only public program in the country that takes that risk. We simply won't reimburse the product. That's taking quite a stand. Not only does that save money, but that saves lives and protects people's health. The deductible is obviously a very strong cost containment feature. When people have to pay up front out of their own pockets, not only do they think twice about spending the money for the drug, but it educates them about the cost of these products, and we find that it carries over in their behavior once they become in benefit. Fixed income limits. Probably of all these criteria, the one that saves the most is the fixed income limits. That is, they're fixed in statute, and the only way that they change is when the legislature decides that they're going to change, and that's a function of whether or not money's available to cover the benefit. And then we have a very aggressive provider compliance program. We have several staff people every work day of the year. They're in pharmacies across the state doing audits to make sure that the pharmacies are complying with the rules and regulations of the program. Now, I have a few minutes left, and I just want to give you a little detail on what you need to be concerned about in controlling costs in a program like this. This next slide probably, it's an awful busy slide, and obviously, but we'll move it in a moment, but you know, in a program like this, cost is a function of two elements. It's that simple: enrollments and utilization. Now, enrollments in the PACE program are actually only half of what they were 12 years ago because we simply haven't raised the income limits to keep up with inflation. And there's a reason for that, because the other component, utilization, has been going up very dramatically. As David was saying, this is a function of how many scripts people are using and what you're paying for those scripts and the mix of medications that you're taking. These lines here, just shift that a little bit so you can see the right side. See, this line here represents the gross expenditure line for the program, which is literally going up like a rocket. This line below it, which is parallel in it, is the net expenditure line. The difference is largely the amount of money that we take back in rebates from pharmaceutical manufacturers. But look at the enrollment line here. See, the enrollment line is actually trending down. The claim line is starting to go up dramatically again, too. But what's driving cost in this program is not enrollment. It's utilization. And let me say about utilization that I see the legislator that asked the question isn't here. But the National Institute for Healthcare Management Research and Educational Foundation issued a report in July of 99 describing the factors that affect the growth of prescription drug expenditures. And this report provides an excellent analysis of how prices are being driven by drug manufacturers and what detailing does specifically to those prices, what DTC does specifically to those prices. It's something over which you have no direct control, but it's something you need to be aware of and something that you need to be able to address from a more indirect standpoint, largely through rebates. Yeah, these aren't going to work because the screen's not big enough. And I'm just going to stop it there because it'll give people a headache trying to follow those. Basically, what I was attempting to do is to show in more detail how the changes in enrollment have varied over time, how the enrollment trend has been declining, and then how the average wholesale price has been increasing, how utilization has been increasing, what impact price inflation has had on the program, what impact drug mix has had on the program. And what we're finding, generally speaking, is that price utilization is, price inflation is driving about a third of the annual cost increases, that product mix is driving a third, and then increased utilization is driving the other third. And I'll stop with that.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom. Questions? Representative Miller.
Thank you. Very interesting information. Have you been able to notice any trends as a drug which has a is an exclusive drug and approaches the end of its life and where it can be competing for in a generic market? Have you seen any kind of trends when that is occurring?
Oh, absolutely, and we've documented it in elaborate detail. It's very interesting because over the history of the program, what has happened is at the beginning of the program, when a drug went off patent, like a Tagamet, it quickly dropped into oblivion because generic competition overwhelmed it. But the industry got wise to that. And what has happened in more recent years, as a product has lost patent protection, the industry has introduced a new product that's reputed to be better, particularly in terms of its adverse drug event profile. And it has replaced the old product. So the generics haven't been able to make as many inroads. I think the slide that Bruce or David showed on the generic trend line, how it's flattened out in the low 40s. And when we started the program, it was 12%. Our trend line was pretty much the same until about 93, and then it flattened out at 41%. And that's because the brand manufacturers have gotten very good at introducing new products just as old products go off patent. So, you know, for example, when Zantac loses coverage, Zantac is a anti-ulcer agent. Suddenly, there's Prilosec to take its place.
And the mandatory generics, so, I mean, why doesn't it just transfer over to the generics?
The physician then chooses to write for the newer product. Again, going back to David Slott, the money that the industry spends on detailing is spent very effectively because it gets physicians and through direct-to-consumer advertising now patients to say that they want the Prilosec instead of the Zantac. In our program, as in most programs, if the prescriber writes for Zantac, we're only going to pay for the ranitidine, which is the generic. But if the prescriber tears up the Zantac script and writes for Prilosec, we don't have any choice. The only answer to that kind of problem is one that we are studying very carefully, and that's therapeutic substitution. We would say that in the anti-ulcer class, we're not going to pay for Prilosec. We're not going to pay for any proton pump inhibitor because we feel that the H2 blockers are an effective therapy. Now, if you've been tried on the H2 blocker and you've had a problem or it's not working for you, then we'll give a medical exception and you can go to the proton pump inhibitor. That's therapeutic substitution. That's a lot different from generic substitution, and that is political dynamite.
Yeah.
That's practicing medicine.
Yeah.
But that's where we're at. That's where we're at.
That.
Well, you know, most people, you've heard of formularies. I mean, most commercial prescription reimbursement programs use restricted formularies. There, somebody makes a decision not to pay for a drug based upon which manufacturer gives them the best deal. To me, that's kind of arbitrary. I would rather make the decision based upon clinical reasoning. If the H2 blocker works for most people, why am I paying for a proton pump inhibitor that can be five and six times as expensive? I think you can make a decision about which drugs to pay for and which not to pay for on a clinical basis and save a lot of money.
And that leads to the next question. You've just indicated you're pretty hard-nosed when it comes to establishing a formulary. What consultation do you have in establishing this formulary?
Okay, well, we're hard-nosed, but we don't have a formulary. What we have is a mandatory drug utilization review edit. What we do, what we have done since 1992 when we implemented this activity, is that we bring in from around the country physicians, pharmacists, people who are widely written, widely acknowledged experts in geriatric pharmacology. And we have them serve as a committee to us to help us set this criteria. And it's based on their input and their endorsement that we then adopt this hard-nosed approach that says, okay, if you've been taking an H2 blocker at a therapeutic dose for more than 70 days, we're not going to pay for it anymore. We'll pay for the maintenance dose, but we're not going to pay for any more at the therapeutic dose. Or as it is across most therapeutic classes with older people, we'll pay at this dose which is the lower dose, but we won't pay at the higher dose. All of that is based upon the endorsement of this committee. So it's not like a bunch of bureaucrats sitting under the dome saying, well, we're not going to pay for that because it's too expensive. It's pure clinical input from healthcare professionals that are widely acknowledged as the best in geriatric pharmacology. And we pay a lot of money for that. When we have that committee meet, we laugh about it in Pennsylvania. It's the most expensive state government committee meeting that we have, including the cabinet. It cost us $25,000 a day because we pay these people to do what they do best. You got to have that expertise.
Question. I have the microphone. Actually, I have probably three or four questions. You asserted that the cost of the program was about $1 million a day. Is that state cost, or is that including rebate and a patient contribution?
The $1 million is the gross payout. Once we take back the rebates and so forth, the third-party liability recoveries, audit recoveries, and so forth, it gets down to about $800,000 net per day.
That's still
growing at 20%.
That's still a pretty high cost. You asserted there were 235,000 enrollees in the program. At $1 million a day or so, that's about $4 per recipient on average. Do you have the median cost as well as the average cost?
I do, but not off the top of my head. I can. You should get a copy of the annual report.
Okay.
Since you're the chair.
When you look at Medicaid statistics in terms of where the cost is, there tend to be a very small number of patients that are very high cost. In terms of this program, I would suspect that statistic is true as well.
No, it's not.
It's not?
No, it's not. The top 10% of the enrollment account for about 30% of our outlays. But beyond that, it's pretty evenly distributed. Once you knock out the 15% who during the course of an average year don't even use the benefit.
Have you done anything to look at case management?
Oh, yes.
And give us an idea of what sorts of things those are.
Yeah, we actually are heavily into case management. I don't list it as a cost containment feature because we're not sure what it's saving us. We know that administratively it's costing us a lot, but that's all relative. I mean, the program only spends 3% of its outlays on administration. But in the area of case management, particularly when it comes to the lipid-lowering agents, the asthma treatments, diabetes, and use of ACE inhibitors, we're doing a lot of case management to ensure that people are using the products appropriately, either using them more than they should or less than they should. Pardon me? The case managers are pharmacists and nurses on our staff.